Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loring. Coming up today, we'll pick up a little bit where Ahmed and Summer left off. We'll talk about the controversial North Florida congresswoman and some of the things that she's said and done over the last 2 years. We're also going to discuss a controversial new collection of private data that the U.S. government is engaged in. It's doing it right now in Afghanistan, and it is bringing the technology home. And that'll be the first topic today. And of course, as usual, later on in the program, we'll take your phone calls and your emails. First up today, best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize finalist Annie Jacobson has a new investigative book out. It's called First Platoon, A Story of Modern War in the Age of Identity Dominance. And it reveals the full account of a platoon of young soldiers, U.S. soldiers, sent to Afghanistan, whose experience ended abruptly in tragedy when several civilians were killed under the leadership of First Lieutenant Clint Lawrence. The larger part of the story, one really never reported before, is how the platoon was unwittingly involved in a shadowy Defense Department program to capture biometrics in Afghanistan. This is fingerprints, iris scans, facial images, and DNA. The U.S. Defense Department wants to collect all of that on 80% of Afghanistan's entire population. Jacobson, in this book, First Platoon, reveals how these biometric programs, born out of warfare, have come home to the U.S., endangering democracy and moving toward a surveillance state. I spoke with Annie Jacobson earlier this month about her book, First Platoon, and here's that interview. Annie Jacobson, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I think the place we should start is I've got to ask you what biometrics are, because I've heard the term, but I have no idea what it is.
You know, it's a great question, and when I began reporting this book, I too wondered what biometrics are. I mean, basic Latin, biometric, human measurements, but narratively what they are fingerprints, iris scans, facial images, used to be called mugshots, and DNA. And these ways of identifying people for decades have been associated with law enforcement. If you are a bad guy, the government is going to have your biometrics. But now what is happening, as I write in First Platoon, these big data surveillance systems and the ways in which biometrics can actually be captured on witting and unwitting people are born of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and these systems have now come home to the United States.
I was reading that U.S. Army soldiers who are patrolling critical checkpoints overseas have something called the Biometrics Automated Tool Set. What is that?
That's right. I mean, and this is where it like sort of almost reads like it unfolds like a mystery. I tell the story in First Platoon of a platoon of very young soldiers, just out of high school, most of them were, sent to or deployed to Afghanistan, thinking that they were there to fight Taliban. And they were really stunned when they found themselves in one of the most volatile areas in all of southern Afghanistan. It was called Zari District. And there they are, keeping sort of watch for one of the soldiers who's carrying around this little, you know, piece of equipment, sort of the size of a shoebox, called a BAT, Biometric Technology Tool Set, right? And what he's doing is capturing biometrics on villagers in the area. And the idea behind this was a Defense Department program called Rule of Law in Afghanistan. And the goal was to capture the biometrics on 80% of the population so that you had this catalog of people. So when a crime happened, when, say, an IED went off, Defense Department individuals are now trained to act like FBI agents, like cops on the beat, like detectives, and pull fingerprints off of crime scene pieces of evidence. And then back in the United States, these matches are made to determine who Taliban bomb makers are. I mean, if you really stop for a minute and think, knowing what's going on now, the Taliban's back in control of Afghanistan, you have to say to yourself, what on earth was the Defense Department thinking And why did we spend billions of dollars on these biometric systems? And as I write in First Platoon, the answer is because these systems are now home here in the United States and are doing the same thing here.
Hmm. So let me get this right. So over in Afghanistan, the goal for the U.S. military is to get 80% of the population identified either by their iris, their fingerprint, their facial images, their DNA, or all of the above. They're not just looking at people they've arrested. They're looking at the whole population?
That's right. Because, you know, what do you do if you arrest someone and they're not in a database? What good is it going to do if you have their fingerprint or their iris scan? The FBI has a database. I interviewed scores of FBI agents for this, and they have a system called IAFIS, their fingerprint database, and it's filled with bad guys. As one person in charge of the organization said to me, it's filled with 100% of the people who are in their system are bad guys. The reverse was going on overseas. The idea stemmed from this. After losing the war for so many years, the Defense Department decided, let's try and solve this very human problem of insurgency, right, of terrorists wanting to take over the government in Afghanistan. Let's solve this problem with technology. And they came up with this idea of cataloging everyone through their biometrics and then trying to create a system of law enforcement whereby they could separate out the good guys from the bad guys.
Hmm.
Well, that is what is going on here in the United States as well. And I write about in a very forewarning way, because these big data systems born of war are understood by very few people, and they're made accessible to even fewer.
Well, we're talking with Annie Jacobson about her new book, First Platoon and Warfare in the Age of Biometrics. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. It does sound like it's out of Big Brother. But on the other hand, I mean, what's the worst that could happen if the U.S. troops or the U.S. turns it over to the next government in Afghanistan? What's the worst that could happen if 80% of the population has all their DNA material or identification, their iris scan, their fingerprint scan, facial images in some sort of database? What's the worst that could happen?
Well, there's a lot that can go wrong, starting with the fact that if all that biometric information falls into the wrong hands, then you have a situation where the government knows an extraordinary amount of personal identifying information about populations of people that it shouldn't otherwise have access to. That's situation number one. Situation number two is that data can be manipulated and misrepresented for whatever purposes because these databases are secretive. In other words, the FBI, every FBI agent I interviewed said this to me. They said, Annie, the rule of law system works on three basic components. This is just like for everybody's understanding, right? It's law enforcement, courts, and corrections. So you've got cops, then you've got the judicial system, and then the corrections element of it is prisons and detention centers. And that's how it works. So every time there's a biometric capture by an FBI agent, they're very mindful of the rule of law behind it. Biometric systems are set up by acts of Congress. They have to adhere to certain rules so that there's fairness involved. When you're talking about military biometric systems, there are not any kind of legislative governances in place that you would want to see in a civil society. And that's primarily because in a situation like Afghanistan, we had no control over their courts and corrections, although we'd like to think we did.
As you were talking to the soldiers in Afghanistan, did any of them say, hey, I read 1984 and I think this is really squirrely. This is a bad idea to survey the whole country or 80% of the country. Did anybody, any of those 18 or 19-year-olds have qualms about it?
Well, that is a terrific question. And even more frightening, perhaps, most of the soldiers that I interviewed, and I interviewed 24 individuals from the platoon out of 30, they had no idea what they were even doing. I would say to them, tell me about the biometrics. Biometrics? Oh, that? You see, there's just one soldier in the platoon. He's called the COIST, the Company Intelligence Support Team Member, okay? One person knows what's going on. One individual, that COIST, has the BAT system that you referred to earlier. He's the one in charge of getting fingerprints on someone that they've just detained and zip-tied, okay? So he's sitting there in this sweltering hot sun trying to get a fingerprint scan while everyone around is nervous about being shot. And the guys in the platoon are going, what on earth is this all about? They don't know. Only the COIST knows. And back at the outpost in the middle of nowhere, often with barely electricity, that COIST's job is then to upload that biometric data into the bigger database. It was so secretive and misunderstood that you can see at its very origins, it's existing in a world of secrecy and classification that presumes no one needs to know about this. That's what I find particularly scary and, as you say, Big Brother-ish.
Mm. During the course of the book, there's part of the military that I've never heard about. Let me ask you about this group. Army Futures Command, Control, Communications, Computers, Cyber, and Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Center, C5ISR. What is that?
The military is made up of acronyms, right? I mean, there are so many acronyms. If we really break that down, you could just look at each word and determine, oh, that's one element of the Defense Department that's responsible for processing information that has to do with intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. That last part of it, ISR, is a methodology that has been around for decades. But intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance has changed over the years so quickly, and I've written about this subject in all now six of my books in the post-World War II world. You have overhead surveillance systems that are pulling information. You have individuals on the ground that are pulling information. And now you have a giant database into which this information is going, and an entirely new organization called the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, NGA, which is probably the most powerful agency that no one knows about. This is the agency that is controlling all of that data from all the kinds of organizations you just mentioned and pushing that information out to the warfighter when possible. But as I write in the book, the amount of data that the Defense Department is trying to deal with is utterly impossible. They simply cannot handle it all. So they are increasingly relying on these big data processing software systems like Palantir, which require machines to interpret and analyze information based on AI algorithms. And so if I frightened you with that long, spiel about what this all means, I encourage you to read the book because I try to tell it to readers in a real narrative manner. Here are the boys. Here are the young men. Here are the soldiers in Afghanistan. Here's what happened. Here's what it means. Here's what it might mean to the future.
All right, and I want to get to that. Our guest is Annie Jacobson. She's a Pulitzer finalist, and her new book is First Platoon and Warfare in the Age of Biometrics. I want to talk about biometrics coming home to the U.S., but before we do that, this has the potential for being misused, and that's part of your book, First Platoon. Talk about how you think this biometrics data might have been misused in a presidential pardon.
Well, almost certainly it was misused in a presidential pardon, meaning the platoon of young soldiers in First Platoon fought honorably. And they were led by a young first lieutenant who was gravely injured by an IED. And what that meant was a new first lieutenant came to the platoon. His name was Clint Lawrence. And he was there only for a number of, it was actually a total of 3 days. And he, for reasons that I describe in the book, went rogue. He'd been in an air-conditioned tactical operations center the entire duration of the war until then. And he shows up in this platoon, and his behavior was not consistent with rules of engagement. He orders his soldiers to fire on a group of unarmed civilians on a motorcycle, killing two of them. He's sentenced to 19 years in Leavenworth for the crime. Whether or not people think that was a fair sentence is another debate. But what happened then is apocryphal, because a team of lawyers came in who were experts in biometrics, and they used their expertise and the naivete of everyone else to sell to the President of the United States bogus biometric data, claiming that the men killed were not innocent civilians, that they were, but that they were in fact terrorist bomb makers. And they were able to sell this information to actually 8 members of Congress who signed off on it, as well as President Trump. And only when I questioned this data through Freedom of Information Act, through the knowledge that was being given to me by FBI special agents saying, hey, wait a minute, Annie, this is not how biometrics works. You got to check this. You got to check that. Was I able to get documents from the Defense Department that showed without question that this case claiming the men killed in Afghanistan were bomb makers is just absolutely fabricated.
But the pardon of Lieutenant Lawrence still stands.
Yes, when the president grants a pardon, that's it.
Yeah.
That is it. And I think what it is more than anything is a cautionary tale. You know, people tend to think, oh, fingerprints, the fingerprints were wrong. That's not really what's at issue. What is at issue is that these biometric systems that are garnering an increasingly authoritarian rule over our daily lives, and I'm talking about Americans, not just people in Afghanistan, these systems are understood by very few people. And so you have to say, what's going to happen if everybody is just taking the quote-unquote expert's word at it? Then we're in trouble. And as I write in the book, for the first time in American history, you have a joint FBI-DOD endeavor called the Biometric Technology Center in West Virginia, where all of this biometric data is now being stored. And that includes biometrics on foreigners, as well as biometrics on people in the United States. And when we look today at what's going on with the insurrection, right, you can see how an extraordinary new volume of biometrics is being pulled into this mess. And that has to do with images. So facial images of people pulled off of what's called OSINT, open source information, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. These images are being pulled off and are being examined by regular civilians, deciding in advance of the FBI who might be guilty and who might not be guilty of said crime. This is really going to upend the true concept of rule of law, which is a foundation of a democratic society, and I think it's been twisted of late into some kind of a political statement.
Mm. So do you think, I mean, there are private researchers right now who are identifying those that stormed the Capitol, and they're using facial recognition technology that's available to everyone out there on the internet, or I'm guessing that's the technology they're using.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, but you think that this technology isn't 100% foolproof?
Well, here's the danger in it. The danger in it has to do with Fourth Amendment rights that prohibit unreasonable search and seizures and grant people the right to privacy. And so what you are seeing is, because of technology, because of, you know, social media, you're seeing civilians who are not law enforcement officers. They're not detectives. They're not carrying a badge. They are identifying criminals in quotes, people that they believe might be criminals, far faster than the FBI. I mean, think of how we all watch this on social media. You know, like you say, these individual people who are experts in OSINT, open source information. And they're identifying people, and you can imagine the FBI going around slower, like getting search warrants, knocking on people's doors. And there you have this crashing of, you know, when is someone innocent until proven guilty? What is this going to have? What kind of impact is this going to have on the basic foundation of rule of law, which is law enforcement, courts, and corrections? You know, law enforcement does the work. The person that is accused of the crime is put through the judicial system, and then there is a sentencing process. You have a lot of people that are guilty, you know, guilty in the public eye 4 minutes later. Is that right? Is that just? I don't know.
Yeah. As somebody that thought what happened on that Wednesday, June 6th or January 6th was pretty awful, I'm glad there are these private researchers that are using things like Google Photo Match to match, you know, faces of some of the people that were using battering rams and flags to commit violence at the Capitol and identifying these people. But, I mean, it works all ways. I mean, if you're a BLM protester and you're throwing a rock at a window, you also could be identified and doxxed by people who are on the other side.
These are precisely the issues that I find important at their foundation, right? And what I think is really most alarming is that the big data systems that can aggregate this data, right? So in other words, in Afghanistan, if you wanted to find an individual fighter, the doctrine, by the way, is called find, fix, finish, right? And the finish there sometimes means drone strike someone, okay? So the find, fix, finish doctrine in Afghanistan to use these surveillance systems and biometrics to that end is now home in the United States under what's called tagging, tracking, and locating. And you're absolutely right to point out that while these insurrectionists or criminals that are in any protest that are breaking the law and should be held accountable, that tag, track, and locate doctrine is not known to people, and it's also not able to sustain the follow through in the judicial system. The courts are not able to rule on these issues of right to privacy faster than these protests are now happening.
So,
I believe that the backlash of that will really be troubling.
So, if this biometric collection system is being used domestically in the U.S. to hold images of people's irises and fingerprints and facial images and DNA, if all this is being collected somewhere in the U.S., how does the government get it? And is it the government? Is it the military? And then do I have the right not to have my DNA recorded by the government because I'm not a criminal? I've never committed a crime. I mean, talk about that for a moment.
These are the issues that are happening far faster than the courts are determining, right? So, for example, look at DNA. There was a recent situation reported by two reporters from the New York Times that just last year, whereby a 12-year-old boy was a suspect in a felony case. And without his knowledge or consent, detectives from NYPD took DNA from him. How did they do that? Well, they asked him to come in, accompanied by his mother, he was 12 years old, and have a chat with them. One of the detectives offered him a McDonald's soda, which he said, thank you, I'll have that. Drank the soda. The detective took the McDonald's cup away wearing rubber gloves. Why? Because the straw was then pulled off, and that boy's genetic fingerprint was created from the cells he left on that straw by his lips. He was later not guilty of that crime, but his genetic fingerprint went into a database, a very mysterious database, because it was tied up with the New York medical examiner. It wasn't necessarily with the FBI. Again, this is all information that is not accessible to people, but it took the mother a lot of effort to get her boy's fingerprints out of the system. And that is precisely what's at issue. You can imagine that situation a million times over.
Who's collecting the biometric data in the U.S.? Is it one group? Is it the military? Is it the FBI? Is it the federal government? I mean, who's collecting the data and where is it being stored?
This is a much longer conversation, but I do write about it in the book because you have, you know, you have local law enforcement, you have state law enforcement, you have federal law enforcement like FBI. Separate from that, you have the DOD collecting data overseas. You have the Department of Homeland Security taking iris scans when people come into the United States. You have two major biometric systems, FBI, and now the Defense Department, which is called ABIS, and that's sitting in the basement at the FBI center in West Virginia. And there's a lot that people should know and can know. But the real question is, how much will we know before all of this spins out of control into a situation whereby we are losing privacy at a rate that it cannot be, you know, taken back?
Annie, I got to ask you, just last year I went out of the country for a short trip, like 3 days to a wedding out of the country. Came back, my iris was scanned. Who has that data about my iris now when I came in through customs? Does somebody have a picture of my iris somewhere in the federal government?
Absolutely, they have that information. And for example, there was the State Department recently agreed to release to another element of the federal government all the photographs in everyone's passports. And so you can see this build and this swell of biometric of information. Ultimately, the big picture, it's called identity dominance, which is this idea that if need be, law enforcement can know everything about you. It can dominate. It can know more about your identity than anyone else. I think on that note, I must jump off.
Okay, let me just say, Annie Jacobson, author of First Platoon and Warfare in the Age of Biometrics, thank you for coming on WMNF.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that was my interview with Annie Jacobson about the collection of biometrics on Afghan civilians and on U.S. citizens, something that's really below the radar right now, but she's warning about it and the danger it presents to our Fourth Amendment rights. Annie Jacobson is the author of the Pulitzer Prize finalist in history, The Pentagon's Brain, also a New York Times bestsellers, Area 51 and Operation Paperclip. She was a contributing editor at Los Angeles Times Magazine and a graduate of Princeton University. The book we were talking about today was called First Platoon. And if you want to comment about the program, you can email us here in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. And we're going to open up the phone lines and talk about some other issues in the news. We can talk about biometrics, but let's talk about a few more things, too. And I want to get to the case of the congresswoman from North Georgia and all the controversy that she has generated this week. Let me mention a few other stories before we get there. First of all, yesterday, State Senator Jeff Brandis from Pinellas County filed a bill that would put limits on that new state constitutional amendment that would raise the minimum wage gradually to $15 an hour by the year 2026. Senator Brandis would block the increased minimum wage for people who are under 21, convicted felons, state prisoners, and what he calls hard-to-hire employees, although he hasn't said what a hard-to-hire employee is. The Florida Democratic Party chair, Manny Diaz, criticized the Brandis bill as ridiculous and discriminatory. And I'm sure we're going to hear a whole lot more about that as the weeks go on. The legislature meets beginning in March. The town of Palm Beach is considering its legal options as ex-President Trump is still living at his Mar-a-Lago club. That's a violation of a 1993 agreement. The town manager in Palm Beach says that they are examining their options and the matter might be discussed at the town council's February meeting. Trump and the town agreed nearly 30 years ago when he turned the estate into a private club that he or anyone else would not live at the club more than 21 days a year. Trump's office disputes that there's any agreement at all. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is proposing a $96.6 billion budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1st. The proposal is an increase of $4.3 billion over the current budget, despite the economic hit the state has taken during the pandemic. Authorities say a West Virginia man concerned about what he thinks is the stealing of the presidential election has been arrested near the U.S. Capitol. Police say they found a pistol and ammunition in the man's car. 71-year-old Dennis Warren Westover was charged with carrying a pistol without a license and other offenses. Police say Westover was animated. He was shouting at National Guard members who were inside a fence line. Authorities say they found a pistol and 20 bullets in Westover's vehicle. And again, we can talk about all of this by phone. Our phone number here is 813-239-9663. Well, in Washington, House Republicans are expected to vote in the coming days on whether or not to oust Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming from the third-ranking leadership post of the Republican Party there in the House of Representatives over her vote to impeach President Trump. Back in Cheney's GOP-dominated home state, Wyoming, momentum is growing there for a statewide GOP censure, and they're calling for a primary opponent for Liz Cheney, who is one of the most conservative members of the House of Representatives. Meanwhile, Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, an ardent Trump ally from Florida, spoke to 1,000 people yesterday. He flew out to Wyoming, and he appeared at an anti-Cheney rally in Cheyenne, asking the people in that crowd to vote her out. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made an extraordinary warning yesterday. She says lawmakers in the House of Representatives face threats of violence from an enemy within Congress itself. Now, here's a report on that from Sagar Magani, who works for the Associated Press.
It's a startling acknowledgement from Congress's top Democrat.
We will probably need a supplemental for more security for members when the enemy is within the House of Representatives.
Asked to clarify,
it means that we have members of Congress who want to bring guns on the floor and have threatened violence on other members.
Pelosi did not name any members, but freshman Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene has liked Facebook posts calling for violence against Democrats, including one suggesting shooting Pelosi in the head. Georgia's Green was already in the spotlight over supporting Facebook posts backing violence against Democrats, supporting QAnon conspiracy theories, and expressing racist views. Pelosi is focusing on posts reported by a liberal watchdog group in which Green raised doubts about school shootings in Connecticut and Florida. The speaker says it's appalling Republican leaders have named Green to the House's Education Committee.
When she has mocked the killing of little children.
The GOP largely embraced Green after she won a primary and now finds it hard to distance itself, given that her views were already known. It's raising questions about whether the party can move past Trump-style politics. Sagar Magani, Washington.
All right, so that controversy is roiling right now in Washington, D.C., and across some cable news channels, and we could talk about that. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Now, the controversy has reached here into Florida. Yesterday, Congressman Ted Deutsch, whose district includes Parkland, Florida, and Green, the congresswoman, is denying that the Parkland massacre was real. Deutsch was speaking to reporters yesterday in a Zoom call, and he said he doesn't think that Green should be in Congress.
Really disgusting as her approach has been to the families in my district, to the survivors of Stoneman Douglas. The Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, should take her off of the House Education and Labor Committee.
That's Congressman Ted Deutsch. He's a Democrat from South Florida. His district includes the area where the Parkland massacre took place 2 years ago. Well, what do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. What sparked Congressman Deutsch and some of this anger was a lot of stuff of what Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has said. She A video emerged on Wednesday of this week showing her, before she was a member of Congress, confronting Parkland shooting survivor David Hogg before she was elected to Congress. Now, this is, we're going to hear some of the audio from that. This is a 45-year-old woman confronting a teenager and a survivor of the Parkland massacre on the streets of Washington, D.C. David Hogg was going around talking to members of Congress, talking about trying to reduce gun violence and the spread of guns in the U.S. And here's Green, an older woman, confronting a teenager on the streets of Washington.
Yeah. David, why are you supporting the red flag laws? If there had been, if Scott Peterson, the resource officer at Parkland, had done his job, then Nicholas Cruz wouldn't have killed anybody in your high school, or at least protected them. Why are you supporting red flag gun laws that attack our Second Amendment rights? And why are you using kids to get to, as a barrier? Do you not know how to defend your stance? Look, I'm an American citizen. I'm a gun owner. I have a concealed carry permit. I carry a gun with for protection for myself. And you are using your lobby and the money behind it and the kids to try to take away my Second Amendment rights. You don't have anything to say for yourself? You can't defend your stance? How did you get over 30 appointments with senators? How'd you do that? How did you get major press coverage on this issue? And how did you get kids? Why do you use kids? Why kids?
Yeah, why do you use kids? Now, how many kids were killed at Parkland? But that was a question that 45-year-old Marjorie Taylor Greene asked of David Hogg in March of 2019 as Hogg was going around trying to lobby members of Congress, and she confronted him and harassed him. She did it twice. She did it in the U.S. Senate offices building, and she did it outside in the streets, pretty much repeating herself. You can see both videos online. Greene said of David Hogg, he's a coward, and suggested that his activism was funded by billionaire philanthropist George Soros, who's kind of the go-to guy that everything seems to be blamed on by conservatives. Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Cindy Philpott is our phone producer today. Let's go to Sean in St. Petersburg. Hey, Sean, you're on MNF. What's up?
Good morning. I think the serious problem is that these people believe this. I have heard friends, colleagues, speak of President Biden as a pedophile, a cannibal, and they believe those types of things. So you've just had the congresswoman on yelling at that young man. They believe these, and we have two diametrically opposed concepts vying for the same reality. It's just simply not going to work, and it's not going away. If you look at the Congress, they're deciding not to impeach and find and convict the president for what everybody can see is insurrection of the most horrid sort. But I've heard his proponents say that, no, it was Antifa that Republicans who belong to his party are old and overweight and simply wouldn't be crawling over the balustrades. My position here is that there are two interpretations of the same facts, and we need to put together a commission that can take all of these ideas from the right and from the left and take a look at them, investigators, to really look them up so that there's only one fact coming out of it. It used to be that you may have your own opinions, but you cannot have your own facts, and that is no longer correct.
But, Sean, if these people believe in conspiracy theories, and don't believe, for instance, that Parkland was really a massacre of children, for instance, or you know, this woman, Green, believes that Nancy Pelosi should be shot. How do you ever convince them otherwise? How do you ever convince them that they've somehow lost their grounding to reality? If they don't believe reality now, what would a commission do to make them believe reality?
Let me suggest this, that we put on the commission people that both the right and the left will agree will interpret the information correctly and come up with the truth. The problem is, if we don't find a way to assuage both parties, we're going to end up in civil war. I mean, I purposely thought prior to the election that we were at that point. And now I find them, they're waiting till sometime in the future this summer when the president will take over, that Nancy Pelosi should be shot, all of these kinds of things. And there are a large portion of the community, our nation, that believe these things. We need people to go after the trail of this and find out what is the truth so that everybody is dealing with the same facts. If in point of fact, President Biden, for some reason, is a pedophile and a cannibal, we need people to find that out. And we need a commission that has the respect of both parties, both sides of the argument, because if we don't have that, we're going to have people that continue to believe these things, and we're going to have a revolution. Look at Mr. Trump. He's somehow going to get by this from people who themselves were at risk of losing their lives and who ran and hid for their lives, and they're going to find him not guilty of that. How is that possible?
Well, I don't disagree with anything you say, but you've got groups of people that worship at the feet of President Trump. They worship the man.
Same as Hitler. I traveled through Germany as a young political science major in the mid-60s, and I met people who had not stood up to Hitler and who were forever tainted by that. There was no forgiveness for those people, and you could see it in their eyes. And I see that if we don't stand up to this same type of attitude, for instance, that woman wanting to dress down that gentleman, that young kid, and is carrying a weapon, and these people want to go ahead and foment some sort of revolution based on absolute nonsense, you might as well say we're being invaded by Martians, and we all need to arm up to protect ourselves from the Martians. But they believe those things very, very seriously, and it's their information that they have comes from the same information we have. They just interpret it differently.
I think they get a little bit different information. I mean, they some of them believe in the lizard people. I've watched the QAnon videos. I mean, they're from outer space. It's like Twilight Zone.
Oh, it's like Nazis.
Yeah.
We might as well start using the terminology that actually applies.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot. Thank you for the
Thank
call.
You,
I really appreciate it. Thank you. 813-239-9663. I mean, what did you think of Sean's call? And what do you think of a 45-year-old woman confronting an 18- or 19-year-old teenager who just survived a massacre at his high school, and then she's yelling at him on the streets of Washington? If you're a 45-year-old woman and you're a Republican, do you justify that? Is that how you treat children who survived a massacre? Let's take some more phone calls. We're going to go to Carolyn in Plant City. Carolyn, thank you for calling Radioactivity.
Hello.
Hi, Carolyn. Your phone's breaking up, but go ahead.
Oh, is it still?
A little better now.
I'm driving, so I'm going to be driving slower here in a minute. I was just going to say that this woman, Green, she wants to disavow some of this stuff. But, you know, by saying that, you know, teens had control of her social media, which is ridiculous, because a lot of this stuff she did as a private citizen, a lot of these things she said and did. But, you know, regardless, if she believes these things, she needs to own them and stop disavowing them. And, you know, she needs to be kicked out of Congress, but this just shows me what the Republican Party is today. You know, she's not alone. McCarthy, Cruz, Hawley, Gates, all of them are, in my mind, co-conspirators to the sedition that happened on January 6th. And none of them are worthy of holding the position as senator or congressman or congressperson. But the Republicans are going to... basically, I believe, become the party that they seem to be, because it's to me illustrated by their vote to not impeach Trump, not prosecute Trump. So to me, you know, they're going to become this very extreme party, and it looks like, you know, they're going to kind of take over the more moderates, and this is what the Democrats are going to have to deal with as far as what that gentleman said, you know, I they're going to have to come to terms with reality at some point.
Okay, Carolyn, thanks a lot. Thank you. Thank you for the phone call. So what do you think about what Carolyn said? 813-239-9663. I've had many members of the Republican Party and ex-members of the Republican Party on my TV program. Not every Republican believes this, but the people who are in office and the people who are in charge of the party don't seem to speak out against this. Why is that? The people that I've spoken to are all either ex-members of the party, still conservative, but the leadership of the party and the elected members of the party are pretty silent about this. Why is that? 813-239-9663. Let's go to Mike and Brandon. Mike, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Means to an end. That's your answer.
It's an access to power. It's power.
Absolutely. It means to an end. Because if you look at, you know, Trump, why did he have the support of so many supposedly highly religious people? Means to an end. He was going to get rid of abortion. Name whatever the pet cause is, and as long as there is the belief that the person's going to do it, they're blind to all else. Now, she's from the House. The House of Representatives, she's in a very safe Republican district. They knew that when she won the primary, she was going to be the official. Clearly, most reasonable people can see that she is unhinged. That's green. However, in her district, she is the better of two evils compared to a Democratic candidate, regardless of what that candidate stands for. And that's what it boils down to.
But Mike, when we were growing up, the ends never justified the means. I can still hear that phrase ringing in my head from teachers and from religious leaders and from parents. And now the ends justify the means?
Absolutely. And they're mine. Because think about it, Rob. How is a minority party? Right now, the Republican Party has less registered voters than NPAs and Democrats. How can that party have as much power as it does? It does it through the rigging of elections or the suppression of votes and whatever other means that they can do. How else? It's logic. Now, what's it going to change to correct it? I don't know. Look, if you really want to change the Republican Party, especially when it comes to the president, obviously, you got to get rid of the Electoral College. There's no way that they can ever win as is, as the party is right now. They would have to fundamentally change in order to become president again. And until that happens, there's no incentive for them to change.
Yeah, but the presidency is one thing. It's also state legislatures. They're very important, and congressional seats are very important. U.S. Senate seats are very important. So, you know, I get what you're saying about the Electoral College, but it's not just, I mean, it's the way districts are drawn that also
Correct. I agree. Yes, I agree with you. But the thing is, the question you asked, how does the Republican Party itself change?
Yeah.
And I do think it does start with the presidency.
Okay.
If you can no longer win the presidency, the party itself would have to reflect what most people would want. Thank you very much.
Mike, thanks a lot. Thank you. I don't mean to cut you off. We've got every line lit. Let's go to Ron in West Tampa. Hey, Ron, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Ron. Well, first of all, Sean's call was very good. I'd love to hear more from him. He sounds like a very learned guy, and I appreciate hearing Sean's opinions. I think the woman Green, I mean, first of all, she is just beyond irresponsible, but I think the way she has spoken, especially to that student, was irresponsible, rude. It expresses basically a very pathological immaturity, and I'm saying that in a very polite way. To say the things she said and confronting that student and all her stances basically are so out there and so unreasonable that it's really frightening. The Democrats as a party nationally had better find a way more than ever to, you know, to stand up against this kind of incredible radicalism that is tearing the Republican Party apart, because there's like this rational bit of it that's kind of like the old days. And now you've got these post-Trump people that are just looking at things very, very radically. And I'm kind of broad-brushing you with that word. I also wanted to make a quick point. Thank you for your interview with the author, Annie Jacobson. That was fantastic. And my respect for her grew as I listened. And also the book that she wrote, the one that she talked about, But Operation Paperclip, which I've seen and heard about, and also Area 51, and I'm more inspired than ever to want to get those books and read them, because I was very, very impressed by her thoroughness in discussing that topic today. So, again, thanks again.
All right.
For doing that.
Ron, thank you.
Right.
Thank you for the compliment. Annie Jacobson, thanks you too. Brian in West Tampa writes, with all the news about Georgia QAnon Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, I saw an incredible show last night on Vice TV about QAnon. All I can say is that everyone needs to watch this. The rise of conspiratorial white supremacists rising to power. This MAGA QAnon cult is sadly for real, writes Brian. Brian, send me the name of that. I did not watch Vice TV last night. And Patrick writes, when you have a country in which QAnon nutcases can thrive in a national Congress, it's hopeless, writes Patrick. Hey, by the way, I just want to say that M&F came up short during its fund drive. I'm sorry to insert this commercial, but we need your donations. We're about $5,000 short from the two-day fund drive. So if you can, make a contribution at WMNF.org. Let's go to Jeanette in Gulfport. Hi, Jeanette. You're on M&F. What's up?
Hi, Rob. Yeah, I was totally shocked when Marjorie Taylor Greene got elected or put in, you know, as a congresswoman. And I think that she should be removed. She should be made to be removed. I don't know how they do that. But if she's going to say, you know, I think that Pelosi should be shot in the head and things like that, I mean, I think that that's just egregious. We should never let anybody be doing that who's a politician. And the other thing I want to say is that The New Yorker has an article out right now that Taylor Greene said that that wasn't really her in the video. That was really George Soros.
That's got to be an Andy Borowitz column. Yeah.
Disguised as her. Yeah. This is insanity.
Yeah. No, that's satire. But,
okay,
but, yeah.
That's satire, but it's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's very funny. Andy Borowitz is a great columnist, a great writer, very clever.
She would say something like that, though, wouldn't she?
Yeah, well, I don't know if she'd say. She's gone pretty far. I don't know if she's gone that far, but it's funny.
Well, the way that QAnon is, they believe any crazy story.
Well, that is the problem, and I've watched those QAnon videos, not all of them, but they say some crazy things. One related video says that Joe Biden accepted the office on the green screen, and he wasn't there on the steps of the Capitol. That's one of the videos that's being shared by QAnon types right
wow,
now.
Wow, I haven't seen that, but I try to stay away from those.
Well, I understand. It's probably good for everybody's sanity to stay away.
Yeah, I mean,
Jeanette.
I did put on Twitter that video, though, of her berating those kids.
Yeah, how does a 45-year-old berate a 19-year-old or 18-year-old?
Well, she's probably very, very immature in her own mind anyway. So.
All right, Jeanette, thanks a lot. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Chuck writes, the Republican Party has the power because of gerrymandering. That's what Chuck says. And then Peter in Sebring says, reading list suggestion on the 70th anniversary of the month of the death of Sinclair Lewis, read again the book, It Can't Happen Here. You know, I've got that on my shelf. I started it. I haven't finished it, Peter, so I'm going to go back. I'll pick it up again. Let's go to Danny in Tampa. Danny, we just have 30 seconds. What would you like to say?
All right, Rob. I was going to say, it's unbelievable that she's in there. She deleted all her tweets, by the way, that condemns her and that proves that she's guilty. And Laura Ingraham last night laughing and saying that we all know that these are lies by Nancy Pelosi, saying that they want to go ahead and kill people of Congress and everything. And she's laughing and everything. And here she is, just you know, threatening people. And you know, Laura Ingraham people never mention her. They never mention her name because they know they can't defend it.
All right, Danny, thanks a lot. Yeah, I'm glad you watched Laura Ingraham. I was, I forgot what I was watching last night. Leslie writes this, I just keep remembering how I used to get annoyed with Republicans just for being, in my mind, judgmental and hypocritical. Now I sure miss those days, writes Leslie. Thank you, Leslie. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up on the comment line. Here it is. It's 813-238-8001. And record your comment about the show on extension 115. I'll play your comments back Monday morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. We'll get the latest news in just a moment. Thanks to Cindy Philpott. She's been our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lurie. This has been Radioactivity on 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. And in the next hour, unfortunately, looks like Janelle has car trouble. She just texted us. And we're going to hear the Tom Hartman program, which is second best to Janelle. Here's the news.